Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by our platform sponsors, RCAT, the online resource delivering quality building material information, CAD details, BIM specifications, and more, all for free. And Sweet Process, focus on the work that matters. Document processes, procedures, and tasks all in one place, so you can stay focused on growing your business. Angela Donahoe, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Hi, thank you. So excited to be here.
It's great to have you here, Angela. Angela joined Donahoe Group in 2012 as a designer before becoming a licensed architect in 2016 and a partner in the business in 2018. Angela's passion for design and entrepreneurial spirit began early in life, leading her to pursue architecture right out of high school, attending the School of Architecture and Planning at the University of Buffalo, and receiving her Bachelor of Science in Architecture in 2009. Following a brief hiatus in which she gained real-world experience as part of a small, high-end residential firm in Brooklyn, she returned to Buffalo, where she completed her Master of Architecture in 2012. At Donahoe Group, Angela holds the role of Chief Executive Vision Officer, as well as project architect and manager, and she is a firm believer in the power design has over every aspect of our lives. Her goal as an architect and partner is to provide her clients with a positive experience throughout the design and construction process, and to collaboratively use design to discover and solve her clients' problems. So Angela, I know a little bit about your background and about your history. You're involved in a lot of the things we're doing at Entree Architect, and I'm very interested in your history at Donahoe Group. You know, I recognize your last name is the same name as the firm name, so there's history there, and I want to understand how you progressed up through the ranks of the firm to today. You're a partner, you're leading the firm's vision and future focus as a legacy firm. So I want to talk about that. I want to talk about, you know, how the challenges and the rewards of sort of growing up as a professional in a legacy firm and now leading that legacy firm. Before we get too deep into this episode, let's say thank you to our platform sponsors, RCAT and Sweet Process. I'm hearing it more and more among the Entree Architect community. The workload is piling up. With project conditions changing and limited time to get things done, it's good to have information at your fingertips. RCAT.com provides architects, engineers, spec writers, and contractors with the most comprehensive libraries of building product content. And it's designed so you can access it quickly and efficiently. Even better, Arcat.com is free to use and requires no registration, no credit card, no email. So visit today at arcat.com and access the information you need now. That's arcat.com, A-R-C-A-T.com. Let me ask you a question. Are you frustrated with how long it takes to get stuff done in your architecture firm? Or how chaotic and confusing things seem to get? Well, let me tell you about a much better way of getting work done. Let me tell you about an amazing new tool that will help you overcome the frustrating logjams in your architecture firm. Sweet Process. It's a simple yet powerful tool that lets you create clear step-by-step instructions for every task in your architecture firm. From writing proposals to executing client work to responding to client requests. So everything gets done more easily and more reliably. Plus, you'll have a central place where everyone who works for you, your employees, your contractors, even virtual assistants, can access your procedures anytime from any device. The best way to understand how Sweet Process streamlines your work is to start using it. The company offers a 14-day free trial, but listeners to this podcast, the Entree Architect Community, you can try Sweet Process for 28 days free. Free of charge, 28 days. You don't even have to enter a credit card to get started. Just visit sweetprocess.com/entrearchitect to start your free 28-day trial. That's sweetprocess.com/entrearchitect. And let them know that you heard about them at the Entree Architect podcast. sweetprocess.com/entrearchitect. Please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. So share your origin story. When did you discover your passion for architecture? Who or what inspired you to become an architect? And share your journey with us here at Entree Architect Podcast.
So looking back at my childhood and growing up, it's pretty easy to see that I was interested in architecture, but I actually didn't know, or I couldn't define it, I guess, as architecture until late into high school. And it was actually my high school guidance counselor who suggested it to me. And, it was easy for him. It took him 30 seconds of having known me and looking at what I was interested in. And he knew immediately. And as soon as he said it, and I did a little bit of research into it, everything really clicked. You know, all of the leaf houses that I had built in the yard that had the door swings and the windows, you know, it should have been a really big clue. But it took someone looking at that from the outside to really make me realize that that's what it was.
Were you, as a kid, more of an artist or a builder?
Builder, actually. That's interesting you say that, because one of the reasons that architecture never popped in my own head was because I had this kind of preconceived notion that it was more on the art side, and hand drawing was not really my thing. And so in my mind, those two were so closely correlated, I didn't understand that you didn't have to be excellent at hand drawing in order to be an architect. So I loved to build things and probably loved to take things apart more, but figure out how things work, how things went together. I loved putting systems together, and I loved, you know, imaginary play where, you know, I was the manager of the hotel and my poor sister had to be the person that went around and did all the work for it. You know, the, all those types of, that type of imaginative play where, interestingly enough, I think that's where I got kind of my entrepreneurial spirit. A lot of that shows in the things that I was interested when I was in the things I was interested in when I was younger. So as you said in my bio, I applied for architecture schools and went right to University at Buffalo. Had a really great experience, kind of definitely obviously delved into the world of architecture and design and really refined those skills. And I would say I kind of got away from the entrepreneurial side of it. I always had in the back of my mind that I wanted to have a firm of my own, that I really wanted to run a firm. It was always still back there in my interest, but at the foreground was architecture and design, of course. So after I graduated from undergrad, I knew I wanted to take a break and kind of experience what was out there. And I worked for a firm in Brooklyn. And the man that I worked for was, to use Michael Gerber's his definitions, he was a technician to a T. He was very talented, or and is very talented at a very talented designer, wanted nothing to do with the business side of it. They didn't have, you know, there was no office calendar, there was no organization. And for whatever reason, I saw that as an opportunity to really help the business side of this design firm. And he really let me do this as, you know, a person that came in as an intern. And I really was able to set up an entire organization system and manage this firm as, you know, as a undergraduate, you know, with my undergraduate degree and I was doing design work and, you know, that learning that kind of thing from him as well. But really the part I really grew at and really started to understand my own talent at was running the business, was that kind of side.
What a great opportunity for both of you, for you to have that opportunity to run a firm so young, but also for him to recognize his weakness and to allow you to do that was a huge leap for him. I did a very similar thing with one of the early firms that I worked for. And I was sort of shooed away and pushed to the side and like, you don't know what you're talking about, go back to the drafting board. And so it was such a great opportunity for you both to have that experience.
It really was. And it like I said, it really reawoken my goal to run a firm or to have my own firm. And I even expressed this to the man I was working for, and he said, "Oh, you don't want to do that. You don't want to do the business side of it. It's way too much work. It's way too much risk." I mean, this was also 2009, so a terrible time for, I think, almost all business owners would have stated that at that time.
A lot of pessimism in 2009.
exactly. So I know part of that was part of his attitude towards it. But I'm also a very stubborn and determined person. So I think him saying, "You don't want to do that. You can't do that," was also served as really good motivation for me and really reinforced why I wanted to do it and how I wanted to do it. And you know, I wasn't sure exactly, you know, how that was going to play out, but I did know that I wanted to go back and get my master's. So that was part of the catalyst to bring me back to Buffalo to get my master's. And so in undergrad, I had met my now husband, but we didn't actually start dating until after undergrad, till I'd moved away, till we weren't in the same city anymore, of course. And so when I returned, he also went to Buffalo for his master's. He did not take a year off. So he was already halfway through the program when I returned. And he had known, my husband, Colin, had the idea that he wanted to work for his father, Guy, my now father-in-law, of course. And so when he graduated, he had been working in his dad's office since he was 16 on and off. And he went into a full-time position there. And I was able to experience a lot of that through him when I was there when I was visiting on the weekends. And it was really, it's hard to describe the feeling that I got when I got to be a part of not only that the family, but a little bit of the business. It was really to hear them talk, the way they talked about the projects that they worked on. So, you know, kind of just matter of fact, casually as part of family conversation, or we'd be driving to go out to dinner and it would be, he'd be pointing out houses that he had worked on or telling the stories about the clients. And I really, really enjoyed, his passion for it, his talent for it, and, being a part of those conversations. And so, about probably maybe halfway through my last year of my master's, I knew I really wanted to work for, my father-in-law. I thought it was a small business. It was, you know, we did commercial and residential, you know, it was perfect. But again, this is still 2011, 2012. And especially, you know, where I'm in central New York, we're always a little bit behind the curve on the, the economic curve, if you will. So you know, I expressed to him, I was like, I understand you can't just, you're a small firm, you can't just automatically hire another person, but I just want you to know if the opportunity exists, I would love to be a part of it. And so he gave me an honest answer. He said, I would love to be able to do that, but I, you know, have to kind of decide on the workload. And so after I graduated, there was a project that needed a 3D rendering and program, like 3D programs and visualization has always been a really strong point of mine. So we asked, oh, could you come in for a couple hours? And I said, sure. And then there was another project. And then there was another project. And then there was another project. And, you know, now I'm a partner. No, but
simple as that.
Simple as that, right? But it really was kind of just a natural and organic piece. And it was interesting because there was kind of this feeling of needing to prove that I had value, right? Because it was the only reason I was being asked back was to prove that, because I did provide some value. So that was kind of an interesting dynamic for a while and I would say that's kind of been a trait of mine for, you know, my entire life would be needing to prove that value. And I knew immediately that, how do I describe it? I knew I wanted to be able to help my father-in-law in some of the pieces and parts that he didn't want to do, but he had a lot of respect for on the business side. And like my boss, when I was working in New York City, my father-in-law has always been very, very open about, these are the things I want to happen, but I don't want to do. Take it and run with it. From, you know, when we were both, my husband and I were quite young in the architectural world and didn't have a ton of experience. And he really let us experiment with some things. And he really let us kind of take the reins a little bit on some pieces that now looking back, it's kind of terrifying. but it was a great experience and it was really great. And you know, we started having conversations about partnership years before it really happened, because it's a long process. There's a lot to it. And Guy really wanted to make sure that in passing down his company, that it wasn't about what he wanted necessarily. Of course, that's really important, but it was also about what we wanted as well, because he knew if he pushed on us only what he wanted, it would never be successful. We would never be able, if we weren't all on the same page about where we want the company to go, we're not going to be able to be successful. We've had some really tough and really great conversations about, and not to mention that, you know, working with your husband or wife, your significant other has its own complications to it, of course, with trying to be on the same page. And my husband and I are very fortunate because we are skilled and have interests in very different parts of the business, which leads to some very difficult pieces and parts of how to move forward, but it also gives great value to the decisions that we're able to make and how we're able to move forward. So that was kind of a long-winded bio, and then went right into the how did I get to where I am today?
Yeah, it's perfect. it's so I have a bunch of questions.
Okay.
Going back to deciding that you wanted to work with your father-in-law and your mm-hmm. husband, was there any hesitancy to do that with knowing that they were family, or, you know, I'm assuming that the relationships were strong before you decided that, right? That probably was one of the reasons why you could do that. But was there sort of any second guessing it at any point?
So that's a really great question. And that actually, I think, really speaks a lot to personality, because I am, I'm not a look before you leap type of person. I'm a, oh, opportunity, go, and then figure everything else out along the way. Versus my husband, who is look before you leap for a very, 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 very long time, observe all options, you know, that kind of thing. And in I had a very honest conversation with Guy in the very beginning where he said, because we were just dating at the time, my husband and I weren't even engaged, anything. And he said, you know, Angela, if you guys break up, this is a big deal. I can't keep you on the staff. I'd have to let you go because there's no way that could work.
Was that before he hired you or after he hired you?
It was during the time where I was doing some kind of freelance right. work for him and he had decided to officially hire me. So it was at the time he officially hired yeah. me that he kind of let me know that would be the case.
That was part of his concern.
Exactly. And he was, he was very concerned about that, rightfully so, of course. Because at that time, I think there were five of us and I was the fifth. So that's a big portion of who you have. And I always make this joke. My husband he'll groan when he hears me say this again, but, I think it took maybe about a year before his father-in-law was joking that he would have to let Colin go, not me. we always had that ongoing joke about who would be the one that would have to go, you know. Luckily, you know, obviously everything's worked out. My husband waited until we passed our very last exam to propose to me. I always wonder if I hadn't passed, would he have proposed the next day? I don't know. He promises he would have.
Prerequisite.
Exactly. And so, luckily, obviously that did really work out. And, I wouldn't say I was ever hesitant because again, I'm kind of a go for it and then we'll figure everything else out along the way type of person. But I know there was certainly, it wasn't something that was taken lightly.
Once you were in the firm and you started having those conversations about partnership, how big was the firm at that point?
I think we were probably seven people at that point. We kind of fluctuated up to nine at one point and now we're back down to seven.
Because there's a lot going on in that dynamic, right? There's a daughter-in-law coming into the firm, talking about partnership with her husband and her father-in-law, with other people in the firm who have been there longer, may feel a little ownership of the firm. Was there any of that sort of conflict, and how did you handle that?
So I was very, very concerned about that. Being on the younger side in all business side and still actually the youngest person at our firm and kind of rising up to that level is I was very concerned about it. And fortunately we have a really, really great team that we've been very careful to place where they want to be. So
that's key.
Make sure that, yeah, it really is. And we try to be very open about those and have those conversations and make sure that everyone is where they want to be and that we understand where people want to go. And so we've always been very careful about that. I think it's interesting. It's interesting looking at it now versus how I felt, you know, maybe 5 years ago or four years ago about it. And I haven't really thought about that in a long time, actually. So this is interesting. It's interesting in a small firm because everyone wears so many hats.
Right.
And I think it kind of comes down to, in our firm, it comes down to who can answer the questions. And that's kind of how the hierarchy of things go. So if I can answer a question for someone or I can solve someone's problem, that's all the kind of position that I need to be in, if that makes sense. So I think, I don't know, that's difficult.
Is there a formal organization? Is there a hierarchy in the firm?
Technically, yes. But I wouldn't say it's something that we're like, well, you're the managing partner of so-and-so and you need to talk to so-and-so about this because they're your boss. It's certainly more of a collective,
which is a cultural solution.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, everyone within the firm kind of knows who to go to for answers for what sort of question. Is it, yep. If it's a question about any sort of policy that our firm has or any sort of kind of, what are we thinking we're going to do with this? Or how do we want this system to run? People know that they're going to get that answer from me. And they know they're going to get, they know to go to Guy for a different reason, to go to Colin for different reasons. So we've tried to do a pretty good job of establishing who's in charge of what, who can make the final decision on what.
Did you run into any conflict with employees sort of feeling like you were jumping the line?
Not that I know of. No, I don't think so. Because again, so my husband, Colin, and I, and Guy are the three licensed architects. And in New York State, you actually can't be a partner in the way our business is set up. You actually can't be a partner unless you are licensed. So that kind of helped with the, it couldn't even be anyone else. Because we're the ones that were licensed in the firm, so that kind of helped to.
Right. So there was no expectation of the people who were already there that someday they could become the partner.
No.
Got it. All right, because that helped. That made it easier.
Oh, for sure.
I've been in firms where a son had come in after years of a father running the business, with the expectation that this son was going to take over the business, And I could tell you there was conflict. I don't know if it was open conflict, but there was definitely, cultural problems that had to be overcome. And some of them were overcome pretty well and some of them were challenging. So as you moved up through the ranks and you were planning this succession plan, basically, as Guy starts thinking about his future and where he wants to go and where you and Colin would like to take the firm, and first in collaboration with Guy, but eventually just the two of you. Mm-hmm. What kind of planning did you do? You said you had some pretty deep conversations about some of the things that were going on. So talk about those conversations a little bit. And were those facilitated by professionals, or did you do that on your own?
I would say that planning is still continuing to this day. To be honest, we've been, like I said, we've been having conversations for a long time. We did speak with, we have a great tax accountant and a great bookkeeper. We had a lawyer. So we made sure when it came to the legal aspect to it, we knew that's not anything that we have, that we have any knowledge about. So we made sure to talk to professionals about kind of the parts and pieces, the legality, the tax, the all that kind of stuff. But as far as the actual direction the firm wants to go and all of that, we really brought it all the way back to talking about our values, why we had have had many great conversations about why do we want to do architecture? Why do we want to do the architecture that we do? How do we want to make our clients feel? How do we want to serve our clients? How do we want our employees to feel? What do we want to be able to provide for them? What's the, what's that path? What does that look like? Do we want to stay the same size? Do we want to grow? Do we want to, what are our goals as a business? So we've really, we kind of had a, we do a meeting every Thursday evening. We wrap it in with dinner and, to kind of make it more of a, less of a working on a Thursday night, more of a kind of a fun, just relaxed. We sit on the couch, kind of have a drink, have a conversation thing. And we had, it's a little bit more casual now, more just kind of what's going on. But in the very beginning, when we started it, we had an agenda set up of these different pieces, going through everything from, marketing and our brand and our values. We went through our whole business organization and really, a lot of talking. It sounds kind of ridiculous, but I really think communication is such an important part to this. One of the things, this is a little bit off of what the question was, but a little bit, one of the things that was difficult and that we wanted to start changing from the very beginning was people had a really strong association with our company with Guy. And I think that's really natural. And that's
really normal. That's probably normal. Right.
And I think that, and so one of the things that Guy actually recognized right away was that if people continue to just identify him, it's going to make the transition much, much more difficult. So it was more than just taking one of us along on all of his, you know, on initial meetings or on big project presentations. It was about how he changed his language around how he presented things and how he let people know about different responsibilities within the firm. So not just us, but about how we are a team and how we are a group and how it's not just him. It is, you know, it's this whole business that's putting this piece together. And that was in just his way of changing that language changed our way of thinking about it and our way of how we present ourselves, which was a really important shift in, and I think really important in the overall transition planning. Because, you know, I mean, we all know the big architecture firms that are just known by one person. And you know that there's so much, especially being in the architecture world, we know it's not that one person that's doing all that work. It's a whole group. It's a really big collaborative effort. And even in, you know, even when you have a sole proprietor, there's still a team of people that are helping them to put their work together. And so I think Guy's ability to kind of take himself and take his ego or his need for individual recognition out of it has been so crucial for how we have been able to promote this and kind of ease this transition to being just him to the three of us. And not even just the three of us, honestly, the entire firm, the group, the whole team.
Yeah, that's so important. And it sounds like that came from a few different directions. One is he's rebuilding the brand, right? The brand was originally Guy Donahoe.
Yes.
And now the brand is Donahoe Group. And
correct.
He had to change not only the brand itself, like the, all the graphics and the brand, the name and all of that, but also the message that he presented. You said the way he spoke was differently. He probably deferred more to you and Colin at certain points to highlight the fact that they are in charge. And I, you know, that's not a question that for me, that's a question for Angela. That's all part of the brand, and internally that's part of, again, brand, but it's also cultural that he needs to do that internally as well as externally, that the staff needs to understand that those responsibilities are being divided up among different people, that they should be asking different people different questions at certain times. And so having that be very intentional, Guy sounds very wise. I've met Guy once in a call that you and I had. I felt that right away, but the more you talk about him, you can see that much of the success that you've had with this transition is much from his wisdom and making those decisions, seeing what the problems may be and taking action on those problems.
That's so true. Don't tell him I said that though, because he'll get a big head. But
we'll edit that part out.
No, it's really been and when you're talking about a legacy firm, we talk about the challenges, right? The opportunity, but the gift that is this wisdom of the experience that he has had and that he's had to go through to create this firm and the experience. That's, I mean, I can't imagine not having that to go back to when, you know, I have a big conflict. Well, you know, and I can ask him, how did you handle this? Or, you know, how do you handle this diplomatically? How do you, you know, when anything from dealing with a contractor to dealing with clients to dealing with internal issues, you know, it's just a fantastic resource. And it's been, you know, that's one of the absolute, you know, best parts about being able to not only just have, you know, be taking over this firm, but to be actually work collaboratively with him, you know, and experience that alongside with him and go through these issues. I don't know how Colin and I would do it without having that experience. So it's really great.
I can imagine that that's very important in a family situation like yours, but that's also important in every firm that plans on continuing beyond the founders, that institutional knowledge needs to be recognized and culturally somehow documented, right? Whether it's through story, where he's just telling the story and teaching the people below him, or whether it's like literally documenting it in video or audio or in writings that he does, in order for that institutional knowledge doesn't walk out the door when that leader walks out the door. It's so important to recognize that and to capture that before it's too late.
It's so true. And I love the idea of a video or, you know, writings and things like that. Guy is a storyteller. So he is, it's always stories. And as I spoke about in the beginning, you know, we're always talking about stories about clients and how this certain piece came to be or how something shifted in the design or, you know, always talking about those kind of things. So it's interesting. And only now I think am I really, really, really starting to recognize not only just the storytelling aspect of that, but the value that I've been soaking up over the years of how to handle situations or ways to deal with different things that come up. It's really fantastic.
Are there any other rewards that come with building a legacy firm, taking over a firm from someone who's been doing it for a long time?
Oh, so I mean, certainly there's the reputation that already exists is really great. It's hard to build reputation and it takes time and it takes, you know, it's to not have to, when Colin and I were first licensed and first taking on a lot of projects on our own, we had to battle the being young in the profession. And that was really hard for us because we felt like we worked so hard and we have all this knowledge and no one's taking us seriously. But the benefit that we had is that as opposed to someone who's trying to start that business off from the ground is that we had a company backing us that's been in existence. We have a principal architect who has, you know, years and years and years of experience. So that was really, really a great, a great benefit and a great opportunity right there. Having an existing business, having that's always really great. Existing business relationships, that's wonderful. Yeah. I think one of the challenges kind of along those same lines is you have an existing business, you have existing systems, you have existing teams, and you have these things that are ingrained. And it's taken us a little bit to kind of take a look at how all the parts and pieces fit together. And well, why does that exist the way that it did? And does it have to? And can we rework this? And you know, I'm a firm believer in the mantra, why be good when you can be great? So I have a tendency to try to rework things a lot that it has to be kind of reined in. Don't take apart this system, not yet. You know, we just put it in place. But really, I think that's one of the challenges. But also, it's I think it's a great opportunity from the first generation of the firm too, right? To have fresh eyes on a situation because it's so easy to get ingrained in the way that you've always done things. And it's so easy to not even see the opportunity that exists to kind of shift things a little bit to make it a little bit easier. That we've had some really great things that we've been able to shift and change internally just because we can look at it from a little bit of a different perspective and different technology, right? I mean, that's always a generational thing.
Yeah. Was there any resistance with any of those changes and how the business ran?
Definitely. I think change is always met with resistance, right? And I think especially when things aren't necessarily really bad. It's hard to enforce change when you're just trying to make things a little bit better. So the one really great part about that is, I think I mentioned this before, but Guy has, you know, a great respect and great interest in a lot of the business side of things, but it's never been something he's wanted to have to execute. So having his support in the background has been imperative to some of these changes and things I've wanted to do or things we've wanted to shift around as we go through it.
Yeah, it sounds like that all three of you have done work on your weaknesses and your strengths, understanding yourselves as individuals, what your strengths are and what your weaknesses are, and others being able to recognize what your strengths are and deferring the things that you're weak at to someone who is strong at them. So, you know, having Guy having built the business and having his systems in place, but then having Angela come in who is passionate about this, who loves the systems and wants to build them better, to tear down the good, to make them great. It takes a lot of courage to tear down something good, right? In order with the expectation that it may be great, you have to have faith in someone to do that. And so I think that is important, that weakness and strength analysis is done both independently among yourselves, but also for the benefit of one another, for them to understand your strengths and weaknesses. That's why Anne-Marie and I work so well. And you said the same thing about you and Colin, is that, you know, your strengths are Colin's weaknesses and your weaknesses are Colin's strengths. Same with Anne-Marie and myself. And we recognize that very early. And now I defer everything that I'm weak at to her strengths, and everything that she's, you know, weak at, she defers to me. And we become ultimately, I say it all the time, that we are the best architect in the world, right? Because because we have somebody who's really good at design and loves passionately about design and how architecture ends up being built. And I love the business side, and it just, it works. And so I think understanding those strengths and weaknesses are really important.
It is. And that's, I love that example of together being the best architect, right? And it's, I wouldn't say that Colin and I recognized it very early, though. Unlike what you said, it's taken us years to really pull that apart and kind of take our own, not necessarily ego, but our own need to do everything, or our own need to be really good at everything, I guess is a better way to put it. It's taken us a little bit to really figure that out and to really kind of call each other on that. Like I talked about our Thursday night meetings where we're having these conversations, you know, Guy has had to say a lot of times, you know, you're both right. You're just looking at it from different sides. He's had to be our moderator. He's, you know, yeah. But it's been really great to have those kind of, you know, deep conversations about and really call each other out and be honest with each other. And I think it's interesting because I think you have to have a certain type of relationship, and it doesn't necessarily have to be familial, you know, but you have to have a close enough to relationship to know that you can tell someone you're not good at that and that your overall relationship can survive. That's difficult. That's not an easy thing. And we're fortunate that we've gained the bravery to be able to have those real conversations, because as you said, I mean, it's so important. And that is what will help us to be successful, is to work together in that way and let go of the things we're not as good at.
Yeah. One of the reasons why we learned that so early in our careers is because we tried to design something together when we were dating and we almost killed each other. and the argument was over the fact that she liked to sketch in, you know, individual sketches, like she would sketch and then she would, you know, do a layer and I would just scribble over the same drawing over and over and over again. And we were trying to draw on the same sketch. And that it was very close to the end of our relationship that day. So we both discovered very early that we're not going to do that anymore. I'm going to do this. You do that. That's your lane. This is my lane. And ever since then, it's just gotten better and better.
That's great.
So you are the chief vision officer, right? Is that what that was?
Chief executive vision officer.
Chief executive vision officer. What does that mean? And well, let's start with what does that mean? What is your role with that title?
Yeah. So we went through and did a whole kind of business organization where we laid out all the different roles in the business and who who was responsible for that.
Very e-mythy.
Yes. Yeah, it was. And so because for a couple of reasons, you know, we wanted to make sure that all the responsibilities were being covered by someone was the point person on it, because having multiple people as point people just is the, you know, how things don't get done. And we also wanted to kind of set up some planning for how we were going to transition things that Guy is responsible for now and what he wants to be able to hand off over the next couple of years, and, you know, and making sure that nothing was lost in that transition. And so the chief executive vision officer, which is quite a mouthful, was kind of born out of the fact that we didn't want there to be a CEO that was in charge of everyone else. That was the top of the page. We really wanted our kind of chief level to be all the same level. So we kind of created that executive vision officer to be the person that was in charge of, or was the point person more of where we're going as a firm and how, and the parts and pieces. And that does really encompass finance. It encompasses marketing. It encompasses human resources. So it does cover, it's kind of an umbrella that goes over that, but we really wanted to make sure that it didn't come off as the hierarchy of one person being the boss, because again, that it's a delicate piece. And that seems kind of silly for it just to be on a chart and a name, but that was important to us to make sure that was clear, that it wasn't one person that had the final say. It was that we're all kind of on that same level.
So it sounds like you're co-CEOs and you each sort of have a strength and responsibility within that leadership position.
Exactly. Yep.
So as the leader of the future, right, of the vision of Donahoe Group, what does it look like? What does it look like in the next 3 to 5 years? Where are you going with the firm?
Yeah. So our hope is, and I will tell you that this plan of expansion was supposed to happen in the beginning of 2020. That obviously did not happen. So we've kind of reevaluated a little bit, right? Sometimes you got to hit pause. Yeah. And so really what we're looking to do is we are looking to grow a little bit, because having 3 architects out of 7 makes for a pretty top heavy firm. So we're looking to expand a little bit and be able to better delegate the time and the resources that we have to our strengths. And again, taking back to that strengths and weaknesses conversation, making sure that that everyone's doing the job that they're best suited for. So we're looking to kind of expand and be able to hire some people that will, maybe even initially it's about drafting and about kind of creating that support work, but we're really looking to, and I kind of have like a 10-year plan of hierarchy of how people, people were hiring and advancements and all this kind of stuff, but we're looking to grow and we're looking to continue this firm, down the road and create kind of a stable system that will support us as architects and what we want to do on both the residential and commercial side of things.
If there was 28, 29-year-old architect listening who found themselves in a position similar to yours, where you found a firm that resonated with you. Maybe it's family firm, maybe it's not, but it looks like it's a firm that you'd love to stay with and transition and someday maybe become part of the leadership. What would be the one thing that you would suggest to that person who's listening right now?
That's great. I would say to take responsibility for things that may even be obviously not things you can't handle, but if you see an opportunity for something that you think that you would be good at, or you think you can take off of your higher up's plate, offer to do it, offer to say, you know what, I have an idea about this. Can I go with this? Can I help you with this? Can I take over this piece? Can I reach out to that person? Always just be looking for that opportunity, because I can almost promise that person, the business owner, is overwhelmed and overworked and stressed and has a lot going on. And if they're not, that's fantastic. But if they're not, there are certainly things that they're not able to do. We can't do everything. So being able to, having someone to step up and say, hey, I can do that. That's the best thing in the world. Having someone that will execute something for you and take care of it and make your vision come true. That's amazing.
And then what would you say to the other side of that equation of the firm owner who has a young architect in their office, that's interested in taking over some of the responsibilities, and the firm owner is a little scared about that, a little hesitant mm-hmm. about that. It's not so sure I want to hand over part of my firm to a young gun. What would you say to that person?
Yeah, that's harder, because obviously I haven't been on that side. But what I would say in that case is that you should really think about what do you really want for the future of your firm? How do you want this? Do you want it to be done when you're done? Because that's a certain path, right?
Yes.
That's a path that can happen. Do you want to be able to pass it on? And if you do want to be able to pass it on, what are the qualities that you're looking for in the person that you're looking to pass it along to? How, what do you want to personally be able to impart on this younger person, no matter who it is, and start thinking about what that might look like in the future and really do some like real soul searching about that, because time passes so quickly. And it is, I think the more time that you can spend thinking about that and the more time you can spend involved with that person who you want to have take over or shows interest in that, the better. Because that gives you, if you're worried about losing control, that gives you more control. That gives you the ability to mentor this person, to shape this person, to make sure that they're going to carry on the business, you know, the way that you want to in conjunction with what they want. And, so I would just say the first thing would be to figure out what you want to do with the business and where you want that to be.
Yeah, very wise advice. Angela, what's one thing a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
I feel like that last question was kind of it. That was my
You could expand on that or just yeah. Say that was it.
No, that was what I was thinking before, but really I think more broadly, I'm going to say communicate, and I realize that's a really broad answer, but I think communication with the people that are part of your team and with the people that you see being in charge in the future or that you share partnership with now, I think is imperative. Making sure everyone understands what's important to you and you understand what's important to them. I think that is absolutely crucial to being able to run not only a successful business, but to being happy and being content in what you're doing and making sure that you have a great group of people around you and a great environment to be in every day.
Angela Donahoe is her name. DonahoeGroup.com is the website. You can learn all about the group and what Angela's doing over there. Angela, this is an important conversation that we just had, because I think there's a lot of people who find themselves in those positions, right, of leadership and young architects moving into leadership, both family-focused and not family-focused. There's a lot of conversation that should be had. So I hope that this is the beginning of some of those conversations within firms, and in the profession, within our community of the Entree Architect community. I hope it's the beginning of that conversation that should be had and continue to have. So thank you for starting that conversation here at Entree Architect Podcast and for sharing your knowledge here at the podcast.
Thank you. I completely agree. And as you always talk about, our overall goal as a community should be to get better, right? We want to create better architecture firms. We want to create better architecture. And I really think the best way to do that is to pass that knowledge on from generation to generation. There's no point in starting over every single generation. Let's continue that knowledge and continue that structure, and we can continue to be better and better.
Very well said. If you like this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a rating, write a review, and share a link to this episode with a friend. Links to the resources we discussed today are available at the show notes for this episode found at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is proud to be a partner with the largest, most engaged AEC multimedia network on the planet, Gable Media. We are curating thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at GableMedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. And check out Entree Architect Academy membership. We have ready-to-edit business resources, live monthly training for architects, a supportive architect community, and Simple Systems, our new business system program developed for you, small firm architects. It's all waiting for you right now at Entree Architect Academy membership. Come join me and hundreds of Entree Architect peers at entrearchitect.com/join. That's entrearchitect.com/join to enroll today. Be well, my friends. Be healthy, happy, safe, and secure. Thank you for listening. Love, learn, and share what you know.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and this sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns. What's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.